how strongly she pursued that, and I think her resilience and the fact that she persisted is words that are so prominent for us today is very relevant. And for a more general readership, I think this is a story of a woman's struggle to define herself, to become independent, and to do what she thought was best to help others in need. And for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer people, you know, I think this is a profile in courage in many ways, because she really stuck her neck out to go for what she wanted, to follow her dream in her life and to make it happen and to continue even with setbacks. And I think that's inspiring. And again, the fact that she was an outsider in much of her life, even after she became a doctor, she wasn't fully accepted into the mainstream. I think that touches many of us who have felt or maybe still do feel to be outsiders in this community, this population today. And I think she's showing, you know, a really great example of how to proceed and how to endure.
Okay, well said. I want to thank our guest, Michael Hellquist, LGBTQ historian and author of the book Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. And you can learn more about Michael and his writing at the website www.michaelhellquist.com. That's H-E-L-Q-U-I-S-T, michaelhellquist.com. And also thanks to our intrepid engineer, John Riley.
This morning, works better with the mic turned on, doesn't it? This morning, our guest is Chandler Klein-Smith, but we'll have a movie review first, so stay tuned. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The basic idea behind the auteur theory is that a movie's director is the author of his or her film. Every person who contributes to that film, actors, writers, cinematographers, composers, all the various technical posts, works to fulfill that vision. This is the theory. And unlike scientific theories, which are either proven or not proven in time, for artistic endeavors, there needs to be quite a bit of wiggle room. Animation in particular can be a serious test of the theory. The director puts his/her mark on visuals, but then the animators beneath him/her will take his/her initial drawings and flesh them out, ideally bringing personality and life to the movements. It raises serious questions of authorship. Did director Bob Clampett make Daffy Duck Daffy, or is that animator Rod Scribner's brilliant work? I tend to be orthodox about these things. I cleave to the idea that the director rules all. But things can happen that do make me question my stand sometimes. The first few minutes of Mary and the Witch's Flower, which opens theatrically this Friday, look for all the world like legendary anime director Hayao Miyazaki is running through a catalog of his greatest hits. There's a young girl's desperate escape from mysterious and ominous captors like Laputa, Castle in the Sky. There's a ravishing flight scene on a broomstick like Kiki's Delivery Service. And there's an attack by strange, pliable creatures like Spirited Away. But this is not Miyazaki. This is director Hiromasa Yonebayashi, whose previous directorial effort, When Marnie Was There, also aped the look and storytelling style of Miyazaki's Studio Ghibli. And here's the point. Yonebayashi does not come by this miraculous emulation by accident. He contributed as animator to many Studio Ghibli films, and even directed one, The Secret World of Arrietty, under the Studio Ghibli banner. And yet, if one didn't know Miyazaki hadn't directed Mary and the Witch's Flower, which is about a young girl who discovers both a blossom that bestows her magical powers and a broomstick that whisks her away to a school for witches where the headmasters are plotting an ominous fate for non-magic users. If you didn't know Miyazaki hadn't directed it, you'd be hard-pressed to make the distinction. And it goes beyond just the look. The broomstick flight sequences have the same joyous kineticism. The settings revel in the same kind of lush storybook detail. The characters emote with the same full-body conviction. Which raises the question, if this is Miyazaki without Miyazaki, where is the Miyazaki in actual Miyazaki? Where does the artistry of the animators end and the director actually begin? One answer may be in a certain soul that the Miyazaki films possess that Yonobayashi is still working towards. Miyazaki goes beyond technical visual excellence to an understanding of his characters and their motivations, imbuing them with a sense of life. Yonobayashi's When Marnie Was There, for instance, felt a little too much like the director was ticking off a checklist of style and storytelling tropes, without going the distance of giving us the human connection behind everything. And the impression lingers with Mary and the Witch's Flower, most prominently in that opening sequence. But it does seem that Yonobayashi is gradually edging away from mere slavish replication into something that conveys some form of human grounding. And if you can set aside the overweening clonishness of the production, the film itself stands on its own as a captivating fantasy. Yonobayashi brings a unique look to the wielding of magic, an energetic, bordering on violent visualization that captures a sense of awesome powers at work, and his vision of steampunkish technology has a lot of character to it. Work still needs to be done, though. A late Miyazaki-esque attempt to reform the antagonists feels abrupt and awkward, and one of the attempts to break away from the Ghibli style with the whimsical choreography of a tanuki-like broomstick caretaker feels out of step with the rest of the production, with Miyazaki having once more announced his retirement. And to be honest, the man has retired almost as often as Barbara Streisand. It is kind of nice to feel that the beauty of his style won't completely vanish from the world of animation. Mary and the Witch's Flower demonstrates that if Yonobayashi can somehow bring his own heart into the proceedings, the promise that the Ghibli house style can live on won't be an empty one. And if you happen to be in Philadelphia on January 24th, come join me as we kick off a new film program in the city, Attack of the Classics, bringing great, intense, and sometimes just plain strange movies back to the big screen where they always belonged. First up will be Dario Argento's horror classic, Suspiria. See it the way it was meant to be seen, cringing in your theater seat. Again, that's on January 24th. Shows at 7 o'clock and 9:30 at the AMC Broad Street 7 at the intersection of North Broad Street and Cecil B. Moore, right across from Temple University. Be there, or be a shape that doesn't possess a pleasant, round outline. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
We're so busy worrying about Facebook over here that we're ignoring the radio, which would not be a first for WBAI in any way, shape, or form. Speaking of which, I didn't say before, and I probably should have, that you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, vibrating at WBAI.org, and profiling, for the moment, at Facebook Live. And the program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. That was a review by Dan Persons, although he did outro himself properly. Before we get started talking to our wonderful guest this morning, Chandler Klang Smith, I need to announce the next Nirsif reading. Because, yes, it's already time to start doing that. But I can't do it off the top of my head. I actually have to go to my own website, which for all of you, by the way, is ourwolf.com. And it's a really great website if you are studying what websites looked like in 1995. it very much has that look, although parts of it are up to date. And one of the parts that is up to date is actually the readings part. And it even has the, you know, the videos of the live readings and all that. But yes, our next reading is February 6th, and it is complex enough guests, enough people, more stars than at MGM, so that I actually do have to look at the lineup. Okay, the reading series was begun some 27 years ago by Gordon Van Gelder. He will be the guest curator. Gordon has a new book coming out called Welcome to Dystopia, which he was probably working on beforehand, but when we actually entered dystopia November 7th of year before last, he was probably going, oh, good marketing for my new book. So he is bringing with him, he is presenting, he will be the host, of course, in alphabetical order, Richard Bowes, well, Rick Bowes, Jen Brissett, Jennifer Marie Brissett, Deji Bryce. Okay, I had a problem with this before. It's a simple African name, but I ought to be. African names are not hard, but I have to hear them once correctly before I do them. So I'm going to try Olukotun, which may. Oh, I think I may actually. It's O L U K O T U N. And as I say, since African names are simple, that would be Olukotun. The question is, am I getting the right syllables with the correct accents? But, and I read up on him and very excited for him reading. Leo Vladimirsky. I didn't know his name before, but that's a simple name to pronounce. And then Paul Witkover. So a frequent guest on this program and a former curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings and a guest curator even recently. So that's February 6th. Admission is free, but we will look at you dolefully as you come in the door for a donation, which is to say we're on the dole. And Barbara Krasnoff, Nebula finalist she may be, has become expert at looking at you like, this is good enough for you to give a donation, isn't it? I thought I was the best. And I was. In the days of the WBAI free music store, there could be nobody better than I. That was actually said once in the Village Voice. It's true. In March, our readers will be Elisa Quitney and Nicholas Kaufman, Nick being somebody that our guest this morning, Chandler Klang-Smith, yeah, has read with, yeah, never worked with.
Yeah, he's a dear friend, and we read together at the Hi-Fi Bar a few years ago.
Yes, so, and I recorded that.
Yeah, that was a terrific event.
Yeah, I actually have that, and the two of you and Karen Hewler,
yes,
the wonderful,
absolutely,
fabulous Karen Hewler, who I have to ask at some point, if my name is Freund in German, that's an oi sound. Freund, like uh-huh, Sigmund Freud. EU is always pronounced.
So I guess you should just start oi, calling her
Karen Hoyler.
Yeah,
Karen
Hoyler.
Yeah, what is the she isn't here. But what is the derivation of her name?
I really have no idea. Yeah, I would assume it's also German, but
if it's Germanic,
it may have been Americanized in pronunciation.
Yeah, that could well be. Yeah, I have to ask the forgiveness of the Facebook Live people because usually I have this tripod that only works in landscape mode, but tonight it's not transferring over to I'm getting all these little like wow faces going by. Let's see.
You weren't expecting this to be so action-packed.
Re-accents on the wrong syllable. I prefer calling it Jumanji. Okay, yes. You would come up, wouldn't you, with a thing. Ooh, Eric Taxier is saying, my face!
Did we break your face by, capsizing the iPhone?
Yeah, that's a very good word for it. Although, this image now is better than it was before.
Oh, well, that's good. It improved it.
So we should
knock some sense into it.
Yeah, and now the people are talking to each other, so that's fine.
That's
all
well and good. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the let me explain mm-hmm. why I have so much fun with Facebook Live. I was starting to tell you in the pub before we came over here.
Yeah.
Facebook Live, and then I'll go finish pitching the reading. Facebook Live not only gives people a look into the studio of where we are, and most of the people that run Facebook Live while they're doing their shows, they're just dealing with their show and saying, hey, look, it's WBAI.
Yeah.
That's okay. That's not what I'm doing. What I am doing is I'm dealing with what's going on as a separate medium. People are chatting. People can ask questions.
Yeah, you were saying that this is so much better than just having people call in because you get, you know, many more voices in the conversation.
Yeah, and people, and some people are less shy.
Yeah,
let me ask you to pull the microphone closer to your face.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't have to lean into it. Just move the whole stand.
Sure.
Aggressively.
Is this good?
Yes, but now point the mic up a little. Okay. Yeah, that's good. Oh, that's
all
good.
Right. Excellent. Is that good? Is it picking up?
Oh, much better.
Okay, great.
Much better. Much better.
Awesome. I just didn't want to talk directly into it since you were saying.
Yeah,
to avoid that.
Yeah. So the thing is that even though people can talk to each other right now, talk to us if I happen to see it, because I can only see the last four comments.
Right. Yeah. So it sort of scrolls by very quickly.
Yeah, it does.
Sure.
But while we can do that, and I'm not going to be able to scroll down tonight because if I do,
it'll capsize again.
We capsize again, and Eric feels pain.
My face.
Eric, you should have come here. But anyway,
he's here in spirit.
Yes, bring them on camera. Oh, I see. And that is something that I may do in the future. You see, people who are watching on devices that have cameras can actually be seen.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah, we're going to do that during a show where I don't have a guest.
Cool, yeah.
Where we're just going to play Facebook Live on the radio.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting.
But not only do they chat with each other, not only does a little community go there, and while we only have up to, say, 20 people watching live, by this time tomorrow, it's over 400.
Right,
By that time in a week, it's over 2,000. And one of the things that's so it's not only bringing in new views, but somebody who's watching it tomorrow afternoon might type in a comment.
Oh, that's delightful. At that point. Yeah.
So the conversation is an ongoing conversation that doesn't end at 3 a.m. when this show does.
Yeah.
Now,
that's really neat.
A new medium, the idea of the ongoing chat.
Yeah, totally.
Based on a radio / video event. So to me, we're actually using a new medium.
Yeah, I like that a lot. That's really interesting that it's this constantly changing and developing documents.
Yeah, somebody watched a video on Facebook of a show that I did in late December.
Yeah.
And they had a question. And I just answered it. And somebody disagreed with me. And that started a back and forth.
Yeah.
And that shows...
News that stays news. Yeah. That's terrific.
It really is. It really is. So this is why I urge people. Now, here's the problem, though. If you are tuning in because you want a radio show...
Yeah.
Just stick to the radio. You can watch the sidebar, as I call it.
Yeah.
But it's, later.
It's like annotations, you know, like,
it's annotations, it's the DVD extras of the radio show.
Absolutely.
It's or a sidebar.
Or like having like a companion guide to a novel, like I read one of those. Oh, Gesundheit. Yeah.
I can turn off my mic, but I can't turn off my camera.
Yeah.
I also, by the way, people have a new idea for how we're going to do the Facebook Lives, which is I am using my phone, my camera, which has a great video because this is a great phone. It's been outdone. The Pixel 2 is better than this.
Oh, do you also have a Pixel? I have a Pixel 2.
No, this is a Pixel.
Yeah, okay, awesome.
No, this is just a Pixel.
Okay, this is a Pixel 1 or whatever. Yeah.
Mine has a headphone jack.
Ooh, yeah, that's something that mine
and
sorely lacks.
And it's just tiny, tiny bit thicker.
Yeah.
And weighs a tiny bit more. If I had a choice today between buying a Pixel and a Pixel 2, I'd probably get the Pixel.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally see that, especially the headphone jack. That is annoying that I have to have the little connector constantly.
Or use Bluetooth.
Yeah, I haven't done that. I'm not.
It's easy, you know.
I'm a bit of a Luddite.
Can get a decent pair of Bluetooth headphones for $20.
Cool. Yeah. I may look into that eventually.
On any online store named after a river.
This is actually my very first smartphone, my Pixel 2 that I got, just a few months ago. So
it's a good start for one.
Yeah, it is a brave new world.
Have you gotten friendly with it? Asking questions.
I have found that I actually do use it for that. I always thought that was kind of a gimmick, and then I've discovered no. Sometimes especially because I'm not great at texting and typing on the tiny screen. So
yeah,
it's sometimes
you,
just
you
easier.
You can just say the magic words.
Yeah.
I won't say or. It'll do it.
Yeah.
And then say, text a message to such and such a person.
Mm-hmm.
And you can then just say the text and it reads it back to you and says, do you want to send this? And you say yes. And it's hands-free. Your phone will do that.
And when I was doing an interview, I was doing a Q&A where I had been sent some questions by the interviewer, but I wanted to have a kind of conversational tone in my replies. So I actually was talking my answers into my phone, which was, like a fun way of kind of capturing the rhythms of speech instead of writing in lengthy paragraphs, as I tend to do.
Yeah.
Left to my own devices.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And the AI on this is really good. I've been shocked at some of the things it cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been shocked at some of the things it can do.
We were just talking about the movie Her. So do you feel like your Pixel understands you?
Until I get the voice of Scarlett Johansson coming back.
Yeah, you have to get that upgrade.
And the answer is no. But my partner, Barbara, and I, we not only have a Pixel, but with the Pixel came we bought on sale for a holiday sale. They had the Google Mini.
Oh, I don't know what that. Yeah, is that like a?
It's a disc.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Amazon Alexa, only the Alexa Dot.
Oh yeah.
Only this is the Google version,
mm-hmm.
and all it is the Google Assistant.
Okay.
But I can say, turn on the TV, put on Netflix, and watch blah blah blah, and it will do it.
Yeah.
And then I can say, pause. Go back 10 seconds, go back. So it's totally voice controlled, which is a lot easier than trying to fumble around with those controls. And your phone will do all that as well.
Yeah, no, totally. Now, something that I think that the movie Her really captures that's interesting about, the relationship that we increasingly have with our electronics is that I think that people always have had this kind of intimacy with the tools that they use all the time. But the more that you treat those tools the same way that you treat communication with other human beings, the more... It's not that the tool itself actually becomes more human, but it's like our kind of personification of it in our minds.
Yeah, okay.
It really starts to happen.
Yeah, I'm just talking to a Facebook viewer.
Smart
bleep saying, I want the voice of Sally Hawkins, he says. And I say, so do I, but from the movie Happy Go Lucky.
Oh my God, that's such a good movie. She's
it's a
so
wonderful
delightful
film.
In that movie.
That was the first film I knew her from.
Yes, actually, and I think that's the case
for me. Between her and Eddie
Marston.
Well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
is he the guy who's the driving instructor?
Yes.
Yeah. Their scenes were just electric and disturbing. The scene where she talks to the homeless man who's sort of saying nonsense to himself and actually makes a connection with him. I mean, I can really see why they cast her in The Shape
of like
Water.
I like Mike Leigh movies to begin with.
Yeah, he's
course,
an excellent filmmaker.
The best one being Topsy Turvy.
Oh,
because I'm
so
a
good.
Huge
Jim Broadbent. Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yes,
yeah.
And Jim Broadbent.
Yeah, he's just
Alan.
He's magical
Portner,
in that movie.
And Timothy Spall.
Yeah,
and everybody. Sally, not Sally. Oh, the Shirley Henderson.
Okay.
Shirley Henderson, a woman of a thousand voices, probably sadly best remembered as, what's her name, Myrtle, the ghostless in the toilet in the Harry Potter films.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Same woman.
Yeah. Oh,
same
interesting.
Same woman in her 40s playing a teenager with just a masterful voice, and she's a brilliant actress.
Yeah,
absolutely. In 100 different films.
Yeah.
So that cast... That movie, and P.S., is the closest, I think it's maybe the best backstage musical.
Yeah, effort. It really captures that feeling of collaboration in the creative process in this way that I think is so hard to do. And I think that maybe some of that comes out of the way Mike Lee works with his actors, right? Isn't there a lot of rehearsal and improvisation? And yes. Like, yeah. So, I mean, I think that...
And then they lock it down and they film it as rehearsed and improv.
No, totally.
So when the cameras are rolling, there's no improv.
Mm-hmm.
But getting there, they've workshopped it.
But it's so funny because that, like, mirrors almost exactly what happens in Topsy Turvy, right? Like, you sort of see them, you know, first get the idea to do this show, and then you sort of see them hone and hone and hone it until it becomes this kind of like, this confection. So,
yeah, but so many movies have also tried to deal with what was the problem in Gilbert and Sullivan's collaborative process.
Yeah, right.
And that movie pins it down.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows us the truth that Sullivan thought that he was a great composer destined for greater things. P.S. He wasn't. He did get his chance. He did write his grand operas. Give him a pass.
Yeah.
You've never heard of them, so that, you know.
It always breaks my heart when a creative person is brilliant at something and then they think that that's not enough, or they've decided to sort of look down upon the thing they themselves do. Like James Thurber was like that too, where he really loved like Henry James and, you know, sort of thought that was where it was at with real literature.
He's at the New Yorker.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's like, you know, he there's Dorothy Parker. He ought to be thought of like her.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he was super competitive with everyone around him. But I think also just the fact that, you know, he wrote humor, he sort of saw that as like, I think that there was a part of him that never really thought that measured up, which I think was really a tragedy. So, yeah.
Okay. Somebody says, well, wasn't Myrtle trapped in the bathroom for decades after she died? So she might be in her 40s by Harry Potter's time?
Ooh.
That's a very, very good point, Joel.
Yeah. That's a spooky point.
It's a spooky character.
Of course.
But that movie, of course, the first two films, until Cuarón gets in there, Alfonso Cuarón, the two done by Chris Columbus, really are just kids' films or family films. But by the time you get to the third film,
there's always, like, darkness, I feel like, in the world of Harry Potter. But, yeah, it's like the darkness doesn't really get played out in the plot until later. So,
yeah. But by the third film, it's really there.
Yeah.
It's really there. But it took Alfonso Cuarón. And now I'm going to say something that will have everybody pissed off at me.
Oh, no.
I think that the third film, Prisoner of Azkaban, is the best of the series.
I'm sure that Facebook Live is blowing up right now.
Oh, yeah, it just did.
With people...
No, there's more than one good Harry Potter film. I love the four films that are the finale.
Mm-hmm.
And the same director also did Fantastic Beasts.
Oh, yeah. I have not seen that. Yeah.
Oh, it's good.
Cool.
It's very good. It's a lot of fun. They hired the new professor, the head of Hogwarts.
Oh, wait. Do you mean...
Dumbledore.
Oh, Dumbledore. Okay.
Yeah, they just cast Dumbledore.
Oh, cool.
And I can't remember who it is.
Yeah, I would be curious because, that's such an iconic character. It's like, it's a tough role for anybody else to sort of take on. So,
Yeah. Well, yes, but now this is him as a youth.
Right, yeah.
So you have to find the right...
Yeah, so is Fantastic Beasts like a prequel? I actually don't really know what
about. It takes place in New York in the 20s.
Okay.
So
cool.
It's earlier in the history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a prequel insofar as it takes place in the same universe.
Yeah,
and there
at
are,
an earlier time.
And there
but
are,
it's not
at
really
an earlier
about...
time, doing things that are referred to.
Oh, interesting.
In the Harry Potter books and movies.
Yeah.
So we hear about this book that they all study, which is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Oh,
this
cool.
series of movies starts with the guy who wrote those books,
mm-hmm.
the only one ever thrown out of Hogwarts, even though the principal wanted to keep him. Now, that's all said in the early Harry Potter
films.
Right, yeah. But here it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a prequel, but sort of a predestined prequel. She did not think of that in advance. And here's the big difference. She wrote books and other people turned them into movies.
Mm-hmm.
This is her writing movies.
Yeah. So is she actually writing the screenplay for that as
yes.
well? Yeah, I'm always like,
she's
fascinated.
She's writing the treatment and she's writing the movies. And given the worlds that she does, she owns them.
Yeah, of course.
Good
I
for
mean,
her.
Yeah, absolutely.
She has the power. So let me just see if I can come up with who is Dumbledore in the forthcoming movie. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of backstory on Dumbledore, including that he kills his sister at some point.
Wow.
And things. Oh, yes.
Talk about dark. That's really disturbing.
Oh, yes. And
is
and
she evil or something? Or
I don't know. That's yet to come. What we do,
fighting over who gets to use the car that weekend.
What we do know is that he had an affair with a student, a male student.
Yeah.
And his name is Grindelwald. And we are introduced to him in the finale.
Oh,
of the first film. Mm-hmm. And I will not give anything away about the first film, but I will say that in the forthcoming films, he's Johnny Depp.
Oh, okay, cool. I heard that he was cast in them, but I didn't know who
he's already in
he
them.
Was playing. Yeah, okay.
He's already he's in the first film.
Oh, I mean, I just haven't
but
seen
it's
it.
A
so,
bit,
yeah.
But who he is is a big reveal.
Oh, okay,
and I'm not going to give away that reveal. Just Johnny Depp is in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody should know it.
Yeah.
It's he's in the opening shot of the film, in fact. But you don't know it's Johnny Depp.
Interesting.
And I'll leave it at that. But okay, so I didn't ask enough of a question. Dumbledore, second movie. Let's see if that helps. I'm not parsing this correctly. Yes, I know that it was Richard Harris and Michael Gambon. The idiocy. Are Gandalf and Dumbledore the same person? Yes.
Obviously.
Yes,
they must
obviously.
Be.
They are
both
obviously.
Wizards.
Yes. And
what difference could there be?
And did anybody ever see Harry Potter without his shoes? He has hairy feet. I'll bet you anything.
Right.
He's actually got hairy feet and he will turn.
That's why they call him Harry Potter.
Exactly.
Because of his feet.
Yes, and he turns into Elijah Wood. It's amazing, but anyway.
Indeed. Well, speaking of...
Let me just finish, and then we'll see,
oh,
speak
sorry,
about
of
you.
Course.
Because
yeah.
I've been doing what this other person accused me of, which is I have been totally dominating the show until now. And what I want to tell you again is Tuesday, February 6th, Welcome to Dystopia, starring Gordon Van Gelder, featuring Rick Bowes, Jen Brissett, Deja Bryce, Olukotun. Ooh, I think that's close to it. Leo Vladimirsky and Paul Witkover. March 6th, Elisa Quitney and Nicholas Kaufman. And April 3rd.
Yay!
Chris Claremont and our lead performer.
Well, I
is here now, Chandler.
Not so sure about that part, but like I'm very excited to read.
You're not
with
as
the,
famous.
Yes, I'm not as yet. Famous, and I'm really excited to read with Chris Claremont. But yeah, it should be a terrific evening. I'm very excited.
Oh, it absolutely will be. I guarantee it.
Definitely.
The only okay, I'll tell this story quickly. I tried to tell it in the bar. The very first time I had Chris on this show, his prose editor, Chris writes excellent novels.
Yeah.
And people don't realize it. I didn't realize he wrote anything, but his first book called First Flight had just come out, and it was at Berkeley Ace, and his editor was Ginger Buchanan, and she called me up and said, Jim, you want to have one of my writers on your show?
Yeah.
I said, yeah, name it. She said, okay, Chris Claremont, and she set it up, and he comes on the show, and I read the book. I really enjoyed it. It was the first of a trilogy, and I enjoyed the whole trilogy, and we're talking about it, and we start taking phone calls. And the calls are, can you tell me why it is on, like, page 9 of issue 192, that's the uncanny, on the uncanny, why is it that Dazzler does something that Dazzler would never do if it wasn't in the uncanny? And I'm going, what the bleep are these people going on about? I didn't read X-Men. I wasn't an X-Men fan. I wouldn't be if it wasn't for Chris.
Yeah.
19 years. He was X-Men of the, including the forthcoming film. out of the 12 movies, eight are his.
Wow, that's incredible.
And you know how much he got paid for them?
Probably not enough. Like, no, or I have no idea. Like, yeah.
Not enough is correct.
Yeah.
You want to try for lower?
A criminally low amount, I would imagine. Yeah.
Worse. It's work for hire.
Oh, no. That's horrible.
I hope all the God. Facebook people saw Chandler's face. Work for hire. The answer is Zippo. Nada. Not
yeah.
A penny.
I've done that. I've done ghostwriting that was a work for hire, which I don't regret that it was a work for hire in that case because I don't think that the books were particularly successful, and I certainly didn't want my name on them. But, like, there is something really weird about, you know, when you've invested time and effort and made really specific decisions.
But how about when it's made $3 or $4 billion dollars?
Oh, no. I mean, I would not get over that in a hurry. That would be really, really difficult to deal with.
Yes. So, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby created Wolverine, but they didn't give him a soul. Chris created Logan.
Oh, that's so terrible.
And I don't mean the story, Logan. I mean the character.
Absolutely. The character that so many people fell in love with.
Yeah, he gave them Kitty Pryde. He gave them names instead of costumes.
Yeah, that's like, is he...
Backstories.
Is he sort of just accepting of this is the way things went?
Yes.
Or, yeah. Okay, well, that's really mature of him. I would not be so mature.
Marvel didn't underpay him.
Yeah.
And Disney treated them well when they started getting insurance and things like that.
Yeah.
And when, although X-Men is not part of Disney, Disney still owns Marvel Comics.
Right, yeah.
So they're not doing the movies yet, but they are certainly publishing the comic book.
No, but it's crazy how that
stuff
Chris
works. Is going to be here in a few months, so we can all talk about
it
again.
Awesome. Well, I will be very curious to
to promote your reading.
Yeah.
He will be here. But the that's right, Beth, isn't it? Talking to his partner, Beth. one of the great editors at Berkeley Ace, Beth Fleischer.
Awesome. Yeah.
Who is... Let's see, I don't want to say she is Mrs. Claremont. He is Mr. Fleischer.
Okay.
How's that? Yeah. They're partners. Whatever.
Yeah.
Enough about Chris. We'll get to talk about Chris as you're reading with him.
Mm-hmm.
Gets nearer. And Lisa Quitney, of course, is an editor of Liminal Comics and worked on Sandman, you know, the Neil Gaiman series.
Yeah, you were talking about that at the bar. That's really awesome.
Two of them are totally hers.
That's terrific. Yeah. I'm really excited to see her read with Nick. That'll be another really great event. So.
And P.S., if she didn't do that, her fiction alone is wonderful.
Yeah.
She's wonderful. She is nifty.
Totally.
She is a very, very neat, cool person. Guaranteed you will like her.
I'm sure that I will.
Oh, God,
absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, if you have friends like Nick and Karen Hewler and all that, trust me, Elisa.
Yeah. She will fit right in.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the same Grand Falloon.
Excellent. Yeah.
Chandler, hi.
Hey. Yeah.
It's your turn to talk.
Okay.
You don't write a lot of short stories.
No, I really don't. We were corresponding a little bit about that when we were talking about what I would read on the air. And I know that it, in general, is better to have something that, you know, has sort of a unity. But I am not a big short fiction writer. I tend to, once I get obsessed with something enough to write fiction about it in the first place, it kind of takes over my brain. And so after finishing my novel, The Sky Is Yours, and, you know, working on all of the edits and stuff with my editor, I wanted to, you know, transition into something that would, like, you know, give me more flexibility and allow me to get stuff finished. And so I decided I would write short stories, and almost immediately I dove into writing another novel, which is what I'm doing now. So, yeah, exactly. Like,
is that novel now?
Mm-hmm.
The Sky Is Yours.
Yes. So
is that your first novel?
No, it is not my, well, it's definitely not my first novel that I have written, and it is not even my first novel that I have published, but it is my first novel to be published by a U.S. publisher. My first...
This is very important.
Yes. Yes, we were also talking about this beforehand. So this is my American debut, but I did have a book that was published by a small press in Canada, Cheezine Publications.
Which is an excellent, excellent publisher.
Yeah, that was actually how I met both Nick and Karen, was that they were also Cheezine authors.
Ah.
So that was our initial reason for getting together in New York, because we were all living in the area, but we were all published by this Toronto-based small press, CZP for short. They're really interesting. They do stuff that's at the intersection of, you know, literary and speculative fiction. I would say that they do a lot of horror, and then they do like a combination of sci-fi and fantasy. I guess I would say that my first book, the one that was published with them, Golden Land Past Dark, was kind of had elements of the dark fantastic and maybe a little bit of psychological horror. So,
why is it important that this is your first U.S. book?
Well, I mean, I think that...
strategically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, strategically, when people are pitching an author that is not widely known, then sometimes it can help if it's sort of like, well, the reason that you haven't heard of this person is because they're new. So I think that that's a factor. And it also means that I'm eligible for first novel awards in the U.S.
Like the Philip K. Dick. No, you're not eligible for the Philip K. Dick.
I'm eligible for some of them because I wasn't eligible for some of them.
This is coming out in hardcover, right?
That's true. Yes.
Philip K. Dick is the best novel first published
in paperback.
Paperback,
yeah.
Or trade edition.
But yeah,
that's the key, because Dick never.
Makes sense. He was, you know,
Yeah,
absolutely.
A pulp writer.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's too bad it won't be eligible for that. But I do know that from when my previous book came out, I looked into, like, you know, first novel contests and stuff, and that was repeatedly a problem. So I'm like, oh, this time it won't be. So basically there are a couple of strategic reasons for it. And it's also this book is being published by Hogarth Crown, which is part of a Penguin Random House, and so it has wider distribution and
very good distribution, yeah. Very good publicists,
and great, yeah, great publicity and marketing. And
I've been really lucky. Everybody who works there calls them random penguins.
Yeah, I really think that they ought to be called
random
penguins.
They
penguin.
Really should. Aside from the fact that I have a fetish about penguins, you've seen all the stuffed penguins in my
house.
Yes,
I have noticed those. So
and if I didn't have Facebook on my camera, there would be penguins on the front. And I have little icons of penguins and things.
Well, they are delightful creatures, and it is a delightful place to be published by.
They're smelly.
Well, not...
They're a lot of fun to watch on TV.
Not the people who work for Random Penguin, just the actual penguins are smelly.
Oh, No. Actually, I've had very good experiences with the Random Penguins at that publisher.
Exactly.
They're all very good.
Yeah, no, it's been really exciting. The book officially comes out on Tuesday, the 23rd, but I do have a hardcover. I will show it to the Facebook crowd.
Okay. Check it out. A little? And angle it forward a little. No.
Like this?
Yes, that's it. That's it. That's good.
Check it out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if it were 3D, we could do it.
Exactly. It's coming out of your screen.
And there's an audiobook that mispronounces people's names.
Well, I mean, I think that she does a really amazing job overall. There is a mispronunciation, which is probably my fault for the way that I spelled it out to her. The book is dedicated to my partner, Eric Taxier, and that's how it's pronounced.
Watching right now.
Yeah, he is watching right now. Everybody
online, say hi to Eric.
Hi, Eric. And she pronounces it differently, which is probably the result.
She's the French?
Yeah, well, I can't even remember exactly how she says it, but it's not right.
It's like when you go out to the street and you call taxi.
Yeah, no, she doesn't even say it like that. She says it some different way, and I think it's because of the way I spelled it out when I sent her notes about how to pronounce various words in the book.
Well, we have a policy at Lightspeed Nightmare, which I do the editing on, and so I'm the last person to do a voice check, shall we say, to voice proof the reading. And what I do is I contact the editor, John Joseph Adams, who contacts the writer, and they get on the phone.
Yes, I think that, like, my ineptitude in knowing how, you know, the phonetic way of writing things, so it translates to voice actors, is probably at fault, so it could have been corrected by us talking. However, she makes a lot of other amazing creative decisions with, characterizing
Who's the reader?
Her name's Kirsten Potter, and she's really terrific and highly experienced. So, I'm definitely... Oh, no!
Coffee
mishap!
Yeah.
Here. Yeah.
You keep talking.
Should I get you some paper towels or something?
I'll fetch.
Okay.
I awesome. Know where they are.
Yeah.
So you just keep talking and telling the story of your meeting of working with your narrator.
Okay, well.
And I'll be right back.
Sure.
Oh, hi, everybody.
Sorry. Yes. So here I am on the air talking to myself. So I think it's really interesting as someone who works so often in solitude as a fiction writer to literally hear my words brought to life by an audiobook narrator, and I consider myself really lucky that someone so creative and talented took the job. So I particularly enjoyed the voice that she created for there are talking animals in the book, including a dog.
Lister has come in out of the cold.
Hey.
Thank you so much. And he's wearing clothes.
Yeah.
The last time you saw him, he didn't. He wasn't wearing it, as you will see.
Okay. So I guess I was talking about the audiobook experience, and I was about to say
the decisions that were
there's a character in the novel that communicates telepathically with animals, including a dog, and the audiobook narrator told me that she actually based the voice of that dog on the voice that she does for her dog, and as somebody who also does voices for my dog at home, I related to that and thought it was exactly the right decision.
Eric is saying wah.
So I guess I could tell everybody at home a little bit about The Sky Is Yours. Should I sort of describe what the book is about and stuff?
I don't know. Why don't you tell us what the...
Just so people aren't just wondering, it has people who talk telepathically to animals.
Think nice thoughts about dragons and then...
Yeah, absolutely. So The Sky Is Yours is set in a futuristic parallel universe version of New York called Empire Island, that's being menaced by two fire-breathing dragons. And it's really centered on three characters, young people coming of age in the city. There is a young man who is sort of the spoiled playboy son of the city's wealthiest family. His father is sort of this real estate magnate, and he has a reality show that lasts from the time he's a kid until his late teens. But then his dad decides to cut him off when he flunks out of school and forces him to get into an arranged marriage in order to take over the family's sizable holdings, because he thinks that if his son has, a wife who's more competent than he is, that will assure the family's ascendancy into the future. And then the second main character is the Baroness Swan Lenore Dahlberg, who is an aristocratic young woman who really fits the bill for what the Ripples want for their kid. And so she steps in to marry him, even though they've never met each other. And the third main character is a young woman that Ripple meets when, shortly before his wedding, he flies his flying car into the sky above the city and is knocked out of the air by one of the dragons because he's not paying attention. So he meets this young woman whose car crashes onto this landfill island, which was the biggest mess people had ever made. It's this landfill so enormous it can be seen from space. There's just one person living there, and it's a beautiful girl about his age, and they hit it off, as one does on a desert island, and the story sort of like spirals from there. So he gets rescued, takes her back with him to the mansion, and then sort of the first act of the story is sorting out the drama that ensues. So yeah, so I guess that's kind of some background about The Sky Is Yours.
Now this is not a set up to be a multi.
No, this is a standalone book. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I really.
They are rare.
Well, yeah. You know, actually, I've fielded some questions about that. It's interesting because it's not something that I ever really considered when I was writing it, like making a series. I think for me, it's really important to see the shape of the novel as a whole in order to, especially because this book is really sprawling. It has a large cast of characters. There are a dozen point of view characters at different points, a lot of different subplots, a lot of different settings within the city. So I think in order to figure out, like, within that chaos, you know, like, what's the order, what's the method to that madness, like, I kind of needed to know where it went, and it needed to go somewhere really big and dramatic and final, which I hope that it does.
I think so.
Yeah, awesome.
I think so.
Yeah, I didn't know if you, I know that you had been listening to the audiobook and stuff.
I did not finish reading the book all the way through.
Yeah, sure.
I
totally
read the beginning, I skimmed the middle, I read the end,
okay.
Which is not what one is supposed to do, but
right.
I only started 2 days ago.
That's totally understandable. It's a long book.
Because I've been working on...
Yeah.
In 2 days, I've had to get out 3 podcasts.
Yeah, I hear you. Like, yeah, I think that we would all love more reading time. But like, but yeah, no, I hope that the conclusion pays off and ties together a lot of the things that are set up throughout the book. Like, because that's something that I really love in a lot of my favorite novels. I'm a really big fan of Thomas Pynchon, and I think that, like, one of the things that I always am so impressed with.
Yeah, but
them,
these books are 900 pages
they
long.
Are. They are a bit longer than even yeah. Even my sizable tome is, like, tiny compared to, you know, one of his books. But something that I really love about his work is that it will feel like, you know, so sprawling, so, like, so many disparate threads, and then he will lead it all somewhere that you end up feeling like you see a shape you didn't see before,
yeah.
You know, in the last pages. So, He
and Delaney.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And actually, I compare them a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I've definitely heard people compare the two of them, and Delaney is a fascinating figure, and I've been lucky enough to get to meet him in real life and hear him talk, and I have Dahlgren, but I have not read it yet, which is really too bad. I need to get on that ASAP.
Skyboat Media put out an audiobook of Dahlgren.
Whoa,
which
that's
is
awesome.
Like, how do you do the marginalia and all that?
Yeah,
but,
definitely.
Stephen Rutnicki and crew figured out a way.
Yeah, I definitely need to check that out. That's very cool. So,
yeah. But read it first.
Yeah.
Read it first because it starts in the middle of a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It ends in the middle of a sentence. And it has pages that have where text runs up and down margins.
Oh, neat.
And he does a lot of typographical games with that.
I'm really interested in typographical stuff as well, actually, which is something that I really love about the jacket design that they did for this book, because I think it captures something that is going on in the text.
Oh, I just realized that's the finished book.
Yes.
I have the arc.
No, I know. Like, this is the actual... I just got these.
Is there any difference except the copy on the back?
I mean, yeah. Like, this has the blurbs, and it has, you know, obviously...
This has... No.
That does not have the blurbs.
No,
I did not have,
a blurb.
I did not have blurbs yet when the ARCs were printed. So
who blurbed you?
I got blurbs from Victor Lavelle, Paul Tremblay, and Scott Hawkins.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm really thrilled with all of those. They're all writers I greatly admire, and and they were incredibly generous.
I have to get Victor on this show.
Absolutely.
I met him at the Nebulas this year, and only the one time, even though he's local.
Yeah.
And I've got to fix that, because I love
his brilliant
writing.
And he's, yeah, like...
He's sweet.
Yeah,
he's a charming guy.
Oh, he's absolutely charming, and just, you know, always has such keen observations about fiction, and, absolutely, I, like, definitely would recommend it. I loved his book, The Changeling.
Yes.
That was, like... one of my very favorite books of last year. So, and I think that, something that I was really taken with was what a slow burn it is. Like, it takes such a long time before you get to the point where it's revealed exactly what the speculative elements are and what of the speculative elements that are sort of, like, raised as questions are real. And yet there was never a dull moment. Like, I was constantly propelled forward. Like, so I think that that's really an incredible magician's trick to be able to do that, to just give you just enough that you are constantly wanting more, and it pulls you all the way through the entire book. So,
A listener asks, Have you read Against the Day?
I have not, actually. Yeah. The Pynchon books that I have read are in no particular order. I read The Crying of Lot 49.
Okay, I was going to name that first.
I've read, in chronological order, I've read Slow Learner, The Crying of Lot 49. Was V before The Crying of Lot 49? I ought to know. Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah.
Mason and Dixon. Inherent Vice and Bleeding Edge. So, yeah. So I've read, most of them.
I have a horrible admission to say about Inherent Vice.
Yeah?
I haven't read the book, but I liked the movie.
Really? Yeah. You know, I wanted to like the movie better than I did. Like, I thought it
I
had...
Didn't...
Yeah,
Sorry,
I thought it had great performances. I thought that... definitely, like, Doc Sportello, like, I can't imagine, you know, anyone playing that character more successfully than Joaquin Phoenix. He was, like, so funny and, but also brought, the pathos to the character that he deserved. And I really, I loved, like, moments in it. And Martin Short as, you know, the deranged dentist was wonderful.
Yeah.
But I actually, when I
saw it as sort of a riff on The Long Goodbye by Robert Altman.
Yeah, you know, actually...
Based on the Chandler novel.
Yeah,
which is appropriate because Pynchon was evoking Chandler.
He was absolutely writing a noir. Yeah, it was totally... It's a surfer noir. I just, when I read it, I felt like it was much more of a kind of antic Coen Brothers movie. And then we got this kind of, like, you know, lugubrious, almost underwater feeling... slow burn kind of thing. And it just didn't quite land for me the way that I wanted it to. But then I actually saw it twice in the theater just because the first time I actually came out and felt really disappointed. And the second time I was like, instead of going in with my vision of what this would be, maybe I should be a little bit more open to to what P.T. Anderson got out of it. I mean, like, one really interesting thing was, there is a scene with Doc's ex-girlfriend toward the end of the film.
Which I thought was a little gratuitous.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because that scene in the book I saw as really, like, you know, funny and sensual and kind of delightful. It was like, and then in the movie, it's really played in this much darker way where it's like we're really...
Much more erotic and...
Yeah, it's erotic, but it's also really disturbing. She seems like she's in this incredibly dark place. And I just think that, like, that's...
And also I have to say that in a way, not that I mind nude scenes in films, but it pulled me out of the movie.
I mean, I thought that was, like, seemed appropriate just because that book is so much in the sort of, hippie culture of, like... whenever she's described, she's always wearing, like, bikini bottoms and, like, a t-shirt. Like, you know, so it's sort of, like, seemed right to have the nudity.
But it didn't work up to it. It was, like, all of a sudden,
naked.
Boing.
Yeah.
Whereas if that were to happen...
I'm sure Pynchon would appreciate that sound effect.
Actually, yes. Yeah. But if that... maybe he's on Facebook right now.
Yeah,
Who
that
knows?
Would be amazing. He could be anywhere.
His real name is... Anyway,
yeah.
Actually, I think that is his real name.
Oh yeah, no, that's it's not a pseudonym as far as I know, because I'm pretty sure it's actually not a pseudonym because his family history, actually tracks with the Slothrop family history in Gravity's Rainbow. So,
oh
yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, in The Long Goodbye, the Robert Altman version, in the hippie surfing culture made. Contemporaneous to that era.
Yeah.
You know, because it's early 70s LA.
Mm-hmm.
It was filmed there. It stars Elliot Gould.
Yeah.
As a remarkably dead-on Philip Marlowe.
Oh, neat.
You can't get as far away from, you know, Humphrey Bogart than you can with Elliot Gould, and yet it works.
Yeah.
But you see, in Altman's film... Every time he leaves his house, right in the beginning, to feed his cat or whatever, he has the hippy-dippy girlfriends next door who are wearing either flimsy or nothing, and it doesn't... You see, that sort of sets the tone for this is Surfer City, L.A.
Yeah.
Of the era. This is Malibu.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Anderson film of Inherent Vice... I never really... Yes, thank you. And Joel online points out, and I have never forgotten, screenplay by Lee Brackett. And Lee Brackett wrote both. the screenplay for The Big Sleep for Howard Hawks,
right,
and the screenplay of The Long Goodbye for Robert Altman.
Yeah.
She had a career.
Yeah.
She also wrote something called The Empire Strikes Back, but what the hell. Also Rio Bravo. Anyway.
But yeah, yeah. But no, I mean, I thought that it was a really interesting film adaptation. And what I was going to say about that scene toward the end was that I actually realized, well, maybe Anderson saw something in the material that was there that I didn't see, and I really respect that. So that was like,
I can agree with that because mm-hmm. Pynchon, mm-hmm. like Delaney,
yeah.
they are both so personal and relevant on a piecemeal basis.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely there are, you know, there's so much in every scene to unpack and probably like so many different ways to interpret it. So I hope that there are more Pynchon movies in the future that just take completely different approaches to his work. I think that,
yeah, I want them to start really tackling difficult mm-hmm. writers.
They need to do Bleeding Edge as a movie. I think that would be an amazing Ooh. Movie. I really, really liked that.
Yeah, I know of the. I haven't read it.
It's like Inherent Vice, where it's like, or like The Crying of Lot 49, where it follows one character. You know, this woman named Maxine, who is like a private investigator, and I think that it would be something that there are definitely very cinematic sequences in it, like that I think could. Yeah, I just think that like it seems more convertible to film than something like Gravity's Rainbow, which I think would be really interesting, but you'd almost have to do something extremely experimental with it, especially if it was a single movie.
So, well, you know, well,
yeah,
but you see,
mm-hmm.
I'm pushing for this new form that we have.
Yeah, well, which, the constantly self-annotating document. Like, I mean, you know,
yes,
that's a yeah,
it, very much so, because now you have these TV series.
Mm-hmm.
Usually on streaming channels,
yeah,
where they haven't done it yet, but they should and could change the number of episodes. No, actually, Noah Hawley does do
mm-hmm.
it, that there'll be 8 episodes for Fargo this season,
yeah,
and 10 episodes next season.
Yeah, it's
season.
The number of episodes.
And then
it
Legion
takes. Yeah.
was 8 episodes, mm-hmm. which we should mention is the first X-Men property that credited in big letters Chris Claremont.
Cool,
and it's
yeah.
one of his characters. So yeah. it wasn't work for hire.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a great job with it. And bizarre things, like The Man in the High Castle,
mm-hmm.
which is set in the world of the novel,
right?
But doesn't cover the novel.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I have not seen the show.
It's
so,
excellent.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
excellent. And you want to hate it because it's one of my favorite books.
Yeah, and then you're like, you know, it's doing this completely different thing with the material. Why didn't you just...
I mean, I watch Blade Runner and I say, this isn't Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean the first Blade Runner.
Yeah.
And it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of set in a universe of his, but not that universe. And it doesn't cover his themes. And I thought, oh, that's, you know, that's got nothing to do with what this fellow wrote.
Yeah.
It has its own merit, but it's not that book. Now, take The Man in the High Castle. Same producer.
Mm-hmm.
Only Isa Dick Hackett is overseeing that, just like Electric Dreams.
Yeah.
Or is Electric Sheep? No, it's Electric. The new show on Amazon of Philip K. Dick short stories,
mm-hmm.
anthology series, which I've watched 2 episodes of, and I can definitely say, meh.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are some good ones in there, but that's the problem with anthology shows. Anyway.
Yeah.
They can now weave in and out. Okay, best example, American Gods.
Mm-hmm.
In which they are and are not following the novel.
Right, yeah.
In so many ways. Except we'll see what happens with that, since Brian Fuller and Michael Green, who produced and wrote the first season, have walked out on the second season, taking, by the way, many of the guest stars with them.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes. But
that is one of the things about television. It seems like there is so much potential for screw-ups midway through a project in a way that, like, you know, with a film, it usually either works out or it's a disaster that never screens, but
because it has an auteur.
Yeah, exactly, because there's like one person that's usually guiding it, and it's also like the scope of it is more like explicitly limited. Like, you can make a sequel to a movie, but there still is the first movie, whereas I think with TV there's more a sense if a show goes off the rails, like, midway or even late in the run, it can kind of, like, make you feel like that affects the whole. I guess that's sort of the reason that I'm not really drawn to writing serialized fiction, you know, like multiple books in a series, just because I feel like there's so much more room to screw up. So, yeah, totally.
Yeah. Can you imagine your writing adapted for other media? And that includes cinema or video games or theater.
Yeah, I mean...
Or radio drama.
I think every writer probably daydreams about that. I definitely have made movie trailers in my head for this book. Parts of the book are...
You didn't do a book trailer, did you?
No, I didn't. Are those still something that people do a lot? Because I feel like...
Not as much, no.
There was a period where everybody was doing them, and I just feel like that kind of fell off. I think because it doesn't really affect sales that much.
I think it may make... I was an actor in the trailer for Welcome to Bordertown.
Oh, nice.
The Ellen Kushner and...
Sure.
Terry Windling anthology of stories. And... playing like a burned out elf hippie.
That's awesome.
Which, by the way, is true. And and just say, oh, everybody, you know, is coming from their opposers. Mm-hmm. But now that was specifically put on YouTube for the purpose of letting young adults know of something that mostly just adults
were
reading. So it was trying to reach out to an earlier audience.
I love the idea of book trailers, like, in theory. I just feel like, in practice, it seems like people...
it costs as much as a TV commercial.
I think that that's the issue, is that it's this incredibly expensive thing, and I think it's unclear, like, what effect it has on sales. So, yeah. You know. But I've certainly made book trailers in my own head, and which are much more extravagantly produced than anything that I would, you know, ever pay someone to do. I love Terry Gilliam. He's my probably favorite filmmaker of all time. And so, you know, I think that, like, when I imagine what sort of aesthetic I see my book having as a movie, it would be something like his stuff.
Send him the book, for God's sake.
Well, yeah, maybe I should.
He's apparently back in motion. Is he
doing the Don Quixote movie now?
He is!
Yes, that makes
he
me
is
really
finally,
happy.
He has been making this movie so long that there's a documentary.
I've seen that documentary.
It's wonderful.
It's so great. It's so heartbreaking. Yeah, I mean, as a creative person watching it, you're just like, this is the worst nightmare anyone could ever have.
Yeah, it's a documentary about how he couldn't make his dream project film.
Yeah.
And he got so many starts, and he had a good cast.
Yeah.
And the whole...
He's like Job in that movie. It's just, like, so sad.
And sometimes it's the weather, then it's an actor getting the flu, and his lead, the fellow playing Don Quixote.
Seriously ill and can't sit on a horse.
He's 80-something.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's just like... I guess any...
Welcome to Bordertown. Thank you.
Yeah, I guess any...
That's Eric correcting my...
any collaborative medium, I guess, that you have to, like, prepare, you know, yourself for the possibility of some of those things happening, but to have all of them happen one after the other is just absolutely terrible.
Yeah, one person says that documentary came out over a decade before he finished the movie.
Yeah.
Wrong. He hasn't finished
the movie. He still hasn't finished the movie.
He's in.
Yeah.
Is
he in production right now?
He's in production at this time.
Okay, well, sending positive thoughts to Terry Gilliam right now that
Absolutely.
He's able to finish it. So.
And by the way, while you're at it, change the ending of, what was the name of that? Dr. Parnassus? The Imaginary?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I hated the ending of that film.
Why do you hate the ending?
Now I have to remember it well enough to say why I hated it.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, which aspect of the ending did you
hate? It was just the trick ending that he could have done A, but he does B instead.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like, hey, there's no problem with or without Heath Ledger. They had the footage. All they had to do was have him say this particular thing, and that would have fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, Gilliam ends it in a very complicated way that was unnecessary, making it harder to follow than the end of... The uncut Brazil.
Yeah, I have to... Well, I mean, you mean the director's cut of Brazil?
The director's cut as opposed to the author's cut. And in this case, I side with the author.
I'm trying to remember... Wait, so...
The author is a fellow by the name of Tom Stoppard.
So
my favorite.
There was the version that the studio recut, right? And you're not talking. Neither of the versions you're talking about.
I think that's like a third version.
Yeah, that's the version with a happy ending, which I actually have never seen. And I think I've.
Yeah, well, Stoppard had an ambiguous ending, which is we don't know where the reality is.
Oh no,
Gilliam gave
it
the downside ending.
No, I agree with Gilliam.
And the studio gave it
the
happy ending.
I'm sorry. I feel like you're wrong. I think that ending is.
You have to see the way Tom Stoppard, the author of it, wrote it.
So, is there a version that's actually edited to be what he wanted?
I've seen it. Yeah.
Oh, okay, interesting.
I don't remember. Maybe it was, you know, like a 10 DVD set or something.
Right.
It was, and it was. And it was over 10 years ago that I saw
mean,
it.
To me, the ending of Brazil is probably the most heartbreaking moment in film. I don't think I've ever seen anything that was so profoundly upsetting because, I mean, I think that there's something about Gilliam sort of uses, he uses all of the ammunition in his arsenal to give you that, like, kaleidoscope of emotion in that montage. And, you know, you sort of start feeling like it's dreamlike and it's kind of going off the rails, but you as the viewer so desperately want to believe in it. And then the fact that at the very end, he pulls the rug out from under you and just leaves you.
Well, you see, that is the Stoppard.
But
you see what happens with Stoppard is at a certain point, you don't know which is the real.
Yeah, but I think that...
That's the Stoppard
But point. I think that the thing that ends up being both heartbreaking and a celebration of the imagination is revealing that that is all just happening inside of his head, that he's broken, but in a way what's broken is the knob on the door that allows you to get to that character, you know. He's still in there, like
pardon us all, everybody on Facebook. He's no funny, he fell right over.
No, that idea of, like, he's still in there, but, like, you know, but he can't be reached, and that there's no, you know, that there's no hope in the real world for him is just, like...
Eric again says, my face! Ow, my face!
So, yeah, I mean, Brazil was a huge influence on this book, absolutely.
Yeah, I thought there might be.
Readily apparent when you read it.
I do love it, but...
There's even a mother character that is... somewhat reminiscent of the mother in Brazil.
I'm a huge Stoppard fan. Now, yeah. He's written some bad screenplays.
No, totally.
It's funny how many
Shakespeare
people...
in Love is
he... absolutely
okay. That's him. Okay.
Yes.
Yes? Yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah, but his theater.
Uh huh.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Travesties.
Mm-hmm.
Arcadia, one of the best plays of the 20th century.
Very cool.
He is, in my mind, clearly the best playwright of the latter 20th century.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll give the first part to this guy named Shaw. Okay? But then the second part of the 20th century belongs to Stoppard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, like, you know, obviously it's not, like, you know, me looking down on his writing in general. I just think that that's a perfect ending for that movie. Like, so I just can't imagine it being changed. But... yeah, like, it's
but
very
the thing
Gilliam
is that Gilliam
know, yeah.
changed the screenplay.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't his screenplay to change.
Well,
he's the director.
He was the director.
But but there was a writer, too.
Well, I mean, like...
If you wrote a screenplay and the director all of a sudden said, I like it like this instead, how would you feel?
I mean, I don't know that I would like it. Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't like it because I tend to be very protective of my work. But I think that part of the collaborative thing of filmmaking is that, like, you know, sort of getting something out of someone else ends up becoming a big part of the art. Like, you know, so, like, I think about, like, Kubrick and Nabokov with the Lolita screenplay.
Yeah.
Like, Nabokov, like, but comes to him with, like, you know... I forget what it was, like a 300-page document.
You're one of the few people
document.
Who know how to pronounce his name correctly.
I think that a teacher in college said that, like, the middle part of his name is, it's supposed to be like the sound a bird makes.
What,
like,
he said.
Yeah. That, is
what,
that...
what Nabokov said mm-hmm. is it rhymes with knockoff.
Oh, that's great.
Those are his exact words.
Yeah.
Somebody said some guy named Beckett owns the mid-century, though.
Oh.
And I don't know, and Peter O'Toole has him killed, you know. But mm-hmm. anyway, but Yes, I'm a huge Beckett fan as well. And by the way, without Beckett, there is no Stoppard. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
That's a little bit of a Waiting for Godot.
It's Godot. Of,
yeah.
And there, the pronunciation, very important there, Waiting for Godot.
Right,
That's a pun. It's Waiting for Godot, set in Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I'm trying to think of like other playwrights that I would.
Not Nabokov, as he said, rhymes with knockoff.
Yeah. Well, in any event, the thing that I found.
This is Eric.
Yeah. the thing that I found really fascinating about that whole situation is that, you know, I certainly consider, now I'm getting self-conscious about how I'm saying his name, but I certainly consider Nabokov one of the, one of the greatest novelists of all time. And yet, I also think that if his screenplay as written had been filmed, it probably would have been a disaster. I actually think that...
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But Kubrick has never really... almost all of his work is based on other people's
And he takes work from it what he wants.
And he leaves the rest. The Shining.
Yeah, he completely changed The Shining. He changed the ending of A Clockwork Orange. I think he improved it. That's my
actually
opinion.
Anthony Burgess had good things to say about it.
Yeah, people, but I mean, I know that he was like, well, I saw it in this different way, you know, because in the end, of the book, right? Doesn't the character decide, like, just, you know, he gets older and he changes just because he sort of outgrows his youthful ultraviolence? Like, which is, you know, I can see where he was going with that, but I think it's much more powerful to keep the story focused on that question of like free will versus, you know, versus control.
Although his Barry Lyndon is actually rather faithful.
Really? I've never read the book that's based on. So,
it's
like,
Thackeray.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Yeah.
But,
God, I love that movie. Jinx.
Yeah. And we're going to be doing on this show in April a lot of talking about Kubrick.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, that's really exciting for me.
It is the 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
Of the greatest science fiction film ever
made. Oh, of course. Yeah.
And it's by Kubrick.
Yeah, totally. Well, and yeah, that's a perfect movie, too. They're all brilliant.
Should we take a cut so that you can then read?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to save that song that you mentioned before for the outro.
Okay.
But for the intro, I think something involving dragons and, we say, not a little bit silly, but thoroughly silly.
Yeah, go for it.
Should do it. Everybody stay tuned.
The legend you are about to hear is true. Only the needle should be changed to protect the record.
This is the countryside. My name is St. George. I'm a knight. Saturday, July 10th, 8:05 p.m. I was working out of the castle on the night watch when a call came in from the chief. A dragon had been devouring maidens. Homicide. My job. Slay him. Call me, Chief.
Yeah, it's the dragon again, devouring maidens. The king's daughter may be next.
Mm-hmm. You got a lead?
Nothing much to go on. Said you take that .45 automatic into the lab to have him check on it?
Yeah, you were right.
I was right?
Yeah, it was a gun. 8:22 p.m. I talked to one of the maidens who had almost been devoured. Could I talk to you, ma'am?
Who are you?
I'm St. George, ma'am. Homicide, ma'am. I want to ask you a few questions, ma'am. I understand you were almost devoured by the man. Is that right, dragon?
It was terrible. He breathed fire on me. He baned me already.
How can I be sure of that, ma'am?
Believe me, I got it straight from the dragon's mouth.
11:45 p.m. I rode over the King's Highway. I saw a man. Stopped to talk to him. Pardon me, sir. Could I talk to you for just a minute, sir?
Sure, I don't mind.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a knave.
Didn't they pick you up on a 903 last year for stealing tarts?
Yeah. So what, do you want to make a federal case out of it?
No, sir. We heard there was a dragon operating in this neighborhood. We just want to know if you've seen him.
Sure, I've seen him.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe him for me?
What's to describe? You see one dragon, you've seen them all.
Would you try and remember, sir, just for the record? We just want to get the facts, sir.
Well, he was, you know, he had orange polka dots.
Yes, sir.
Purple feet, breathing fire and smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And one big bloodshot eye right in the middle of his forehead, and like that.
Notice anything unusual about him?
No, he's just a run-the-mill dragon, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, you can go now.
Hey, by the way, how are you going to catch him?
I thought you'd never ask. A dragon net. 3.05 p.m. I was riding back into the courtyard to make my report to the lab. Then it happened. It was a dragon.
Hey, I'm the fire-breathing dragon. You must be St. George, right?
Yes, sir.
I see you got one of them new 45 caliber swords.
That's about the size of it.
You slay me.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about.
What do you mean?
I'm taking in a 502. You figure it out.
What's the charge?
Devouring maidens out of season.
Out of season? You never pinned that rap on me. Do you hear me, cop?
Yeah, I hear you. I got you in a 412, too.
A 412? What's a 412?
Overacting. Let's go.
On September the 5th, the dragon was tried and convicted. His fire was put out, and his maiden devouring license revoked. Maiden devouring out of season is punishable by a term of not less than 50 or more than 300 years.
The one, the only Stan Freberg, producer of the greatest television commercials ever in some wonderful, wonderful radio en route. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Chandler Klang Smith. At least I can say her name if I can't say my own. And, this is he's playing. It's amazing. Like, yes, Spike Jones, yeah. I would say. Well, this is somebody named Eric saying.
Yes,
this.
Love Spike Jones.
They're contemporaries.
Yeah, totally.
Stan Freberg and Spike Jones are very much, they both come to in radio in the 40s. Spike Jones was doing movies earlier.
Oh, interesting.
And then Freberg broke into TV. But there is definitely, oh my God, if those two had ever collaborated.
Oh man, yeah.
And by the way, Freberg did a lot of songs.
Awesome.
A lot of songs.
I will have to explore his stuff. Like, yeah, that was really delightful.
Somebody anonymously, although I'm pretty sure I know who it is, left me the complete Stan Freberg, including a videotape of his TV commercials and spots, but all of his CBS shows and commercials.
That's so
genius.
Cool. Yeah.
He even used Ray Bradbury in an ad for Sunsweet Pitted Prunes, where they're trying to figure out how to get rid of the wrinkles, so you ask Ray Bradbury.
That's amazing.
He did that.
Yeah.
Our guest is Chandler Klang Smith, whose new novel, The Sky Is Yours, is coming out from some random Penguin imprint.
Which from is Hogarth?
From Hogarth.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one who likes old English satiric art has to love the name of the imprint, Hogarth.
Yeah, actually, they take their name from, I think, was there also like a satirical magazine or something with that name? It's actually named.
Well, it may be. Mm-hmm. But if there was a satirical name of that magazine, they're probably going after the 17th century satirist.
It was actually named.
If I'm right about 17th century.
It was actually named after Virginia Woolf's press that she and her husband started.
Ooh.
They had the original Hogarth Press. So this Hogarth Press sort of took up the mantle of that, and kind of
and Orlando was already taken or something like that.
Well, they just wanted to name it after the actual press that she ran. So yeah. So definitely, like, if you follow them on Twitter, which everyone should, the icon that they use is a picture of Virginia Woolf, like for their their Twitter
excellent.
Icon. And yeah, and I think that the books that they choose to publish, like, sort of hold up that spirit of experimentation and making it new. And
you're a part of that.
Yeah, I'm really proud to be. Like, I really, really love the work that they do. So
how long is your reading going to be?
It's about 20 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So
we should probably get to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I will dive in. Should I start right now?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, absolutely. So, just to get everyone in the audience up to speed, in the futuristic, dragon-plagued city of Empire Island, the Baroness Swan Lenore Dahlberg is betrothed to former reality star Playboy Duncan Ripple, the scion of the city's wealthiest family. Despite the fact that he's romantically entangled with Abby, a feral young woman he met when stranded on the city's landfill island, the two feel pressured by their families to go through with the wedding. And so the chapter I'm going to be reading, chapter 12, Committed, is the scene where their wedding takes place. So I will dive right in.
Just checking, the song I'm looking for starts with M.
Yes, that's right.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
Cool. So should I start the excerpt? Terrific. A marriage is a series of compromises between a husband and a wife, Pippi once said. A wedding is a series of compromises between a young lady and her mother. During contract negotiations, Pippi did not even grant the Ripples consultation on the wedding preparation. Every aspect of the ceremony, cocktail hour, and reception is the result of a series of arguments she had with Swanee, the vast majority of which Pippi won. The ceremony is to take place in the greenhouse, beneath a trellis of climbing snapdragons. Champagne afterward in the Hall of Ancestors, dinner and dancing to follow in the ballroom. Everything has been planned for months. "Darling, if I have to touch up your eyeliner one more time," Pippi scolds, sotto voce, though it would be impossible for the Ripples to hear them out here in the hall. "You're beginning to look like one of those raccoons we poisoned under the veranda." "I don't love him, Mother," Swanee insists, tilting her head back. The last thing she wants is an inky teardrop staining the sumptuous dress, the one item she and Pippi instantly agreed on. It's yards and yards of vintage satin, a noir nightgown writ large, lush and dragging with puffed sleeves. Swanee loves her arms in it, all in the subtlest tint of yellowed white, the color of a tooth. They ordered it from a designer overseas. Before Pippi would let Corona alter so much as a stitch, she, Pippi, pinned the whole thing herself. It was a nightmarish ordeal. Swanee stood immobile for hours while her mother circled her, pricking her with needles and hissing about the garment's substandard manufacture. It seemed it would never end until Pippi abruptly stood back and said, "My work here is done," with such tremendous satisfaction, such confidence and pride, that it felt like she had put a curse on all of Swanee's enemies. Was that just 6 weeks ago? Swanee's eyes fill with ruinous tears once more. "I'll never love him, not in this life or the next." "That reminds me." Pippi unsnaps her clamshell purse and produces an amber pill bottle. "You'll want to be good and doped up the first few times. Take one of these after dinner." Swanee reads the label, incredulous. "Muscle relaxants?" "Better than tranquilizers, dear. I'll never forget your poor father's face that terrible night. He thought he'd killed me. And I was so certain I'd only close my eyes for a moment." The processional music starts up, louder than Swanee would have thought possible from a soloist. The amplified harp emits a yelp of feedback. "Mother," Swanee insists, desperate now. Everything has been planned for months. The events of the last 2 days loom and shrink in proportional importance to those long weeks with her mother, scrapbooking centerpieces, cross-referencing the spousal abuse termination clause with the divorce law encyclopedia, taste-testing the mail-order sample cakes. "This will be the death of me." Pippi's eyes are the oldest part of her face, and still the sharpest. "Life is long," she instructs Swanee, staring her down. "Do you have any idea of the scope of this family's holdings? Humphrey and I were up till 3 a.m. going over the books. Things being as they are, your annual dividends will be the GNP of a lesser nation. But if this city ever comes back, and it will, darling, believe me, it will, the real estate properties will put you over the top. Over the top, Swanee. Do you have any idea what that means? The freedom it will give you? You won't have to answer to anyone. Not me, no, not even Duncan. I can see plainly enough he'll be easy to control. You won't just be a baroness. You'll be an empress. You can either seize this opportunity now,
or spend the rest of your long, long life wishing that you had. Swanee looks down at the simple bouquet of baby's breath in her hand, knotted up in a lace handkerchief, her mother's choice. Swanee originally wanted to carry an old silk fan painted with an artful, suicidal lover's tableau, but she realizes now it would have looked propish, cartoony, against the luscious curves of her gown. Her mother was right. Her mother is always right. "Shall we?" says Pippi, offering her arm. They step into the greenhouse together. Fairy lights glimmer in the topiary trees. The satin runner stretches out before them, a long purple tongue. Hot mics in the indoor gazebo. "But Dad, what if we just kept her around for special occasions? She's like imprinted on me. She'd be a waste for anyone else." "That girl is going to the quiet place in North Statesville at 5:30 a.m. tomorrow. It was the soonest they could take her. How could any son of mine get this far in life without learning to properly tie a tie?" The wedding march does not have lyrics, but Swanee and Ripple both hear it the same way. "No, no, 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 no." Osmond wheels out to perform the ceremony, dressed like a priestly executioner in a black hooded cloak. "What is death?" he begins, ignoring the unopened prayer book in his lap. Humphrey and Pippi exchange barbed looks. This isn't in the script. But Swanee gazes at him raptly, an invitation to continue. Ripple scratches his ear. "And why do we rejoice in it so? It is to me of no small anthropological interest that the occasions we come together to consecrate in society are, at heart, concerned with the belching nothing from which we spring and to which we shall inevitably return. Maiming, disfigurement, philosophical revelation, involuntary celibacy, the highest achievements in the arts and sciences, all pass unmarked by ceremony, and often by the world's notice. Births and deaths, these are our sacraments, every one. Even that word, sacrament, evokes with etymological cunning the obsidian blade, the blood-stained altar of the sacrifice, the ritual of old that did not simply acknowledge, but in fact brought about, man's final transformation from a being of flesh to a being of pure spirit. The lone exception, of course, is said to be the business we are employed in now, on this very afternoon, the act of wedding, of binding two souls together in mutual ownership. Marriage appears to be an undertaking by the living for the living, like a slave auction, perhaps, or a lawsuit. Yet in truth, marriage, too, is a living death, and I, the sinister gondolier, tasked with ferrying you to its farther shore. A name is the mark one leaves upon the earth, and sooner than we might prefer to think, our names will be all that is left of any of us. But here, now, beneath this seemingly innocuous canopy of flowers, one partner will willingly forsake her name, and the other will give up exclusive ownership of his. Mr. and Mrs. Duncan Humphrey Ripple V. Though this ugly construction is unlikely to appear in common use, it is this renaming that concerns us here today. A marriage is not about the division of property, or the obtainment of health insurance, or sexual congress, or the public affirmation of private sentiment, all of which can be accomplished by more expedient means. A marriage is a mutation, the artificial merging of discrete elements from nature that turn monstrous when combined. But we would not be human if we did not summon monsters into our midst. Today, young Duncan will devour the Baroness whole, and he will die of her poison. In their place, a new two-headed creature will emerge, strange and born of blood, and we will call this creature Ripple. Birth and death, and so it shall be until the final reckoning. Swan Lenore, will you allow this? She almost misses her cue. I will. And you, Duncan?
I do?
Osmond throws back his hood and with flaming eyes states the benediction. Let the fusion begin. After the final initialing of the contract, the party decamps to the Hall of Ancestors,
where Ripple's portrait is to be unveiled. Champagne corks pop like gunshots. Swanee, her mother's words in mind, has slammed back two flutes before the velvet curtain falls. The family gathers in front of the painting. The videographers fill in the tableau of their clustered backs, the canvas they partially obstruct. "He didn't put my face in it," Ripple says. His voice cracks with disappointment, like a little boy's. Ripple's likeness is the only one in the hall with a title, Wanderer Above the Sea of Smog. In it, he stands on a parapet of the mansion roof, looking down from the heights onto Empire Island below. He faces away from the viewer, his brown hair tousled in the wind, his right hand jaunty on his hip, a hero's pose. But the artist has dwarfed him into insignificance. The city spills out before him. Wreathed with smog, marred skyscrapers jut up like knives. Smaller ruins, townhouses, apartment buildings, theaters and libraries and museums, smolder in their shadows, barely visible. A distant new fire, zigzag shaped like a Z, slashes near the middle of the canvas. Electric orange, as if the artwork itself has been defaced. Torchtown? From it pours a blacker, fresher smoke, which mixes with the rest, becoming one at the horizon with a stormy sky. Most shocking, though, are two shapes, smudges, really, high above the wanderer's head, near the top of the frame. Yellow and green, only implied, they could be mistaken for howlflies or birds. But no, they are dragons. They are here at Ripple's wedding. How well, he wonders, can this bode? "Well, I hate it," says Pippi. "How very grim! Why ever would someone paint such a thing? If it were a window, I'd draw the shades." Nothing live, no band, no chanteuse. If Swanee wants to hear a human voice raised in song, she'll have to go find the klangflugel and bang out the tunes herself. Of all of the things, why did she agree to economize on this, the music at her reception? As dreadful recordings play, decades-old earworms bereft of vital force or meaning, Swanee slumps next to Katya at the banquet table, morosely eating marzipan roses off the three-tiered cake. Swanee felt less alone in childhood, taking imaginary tea with her taxidermied rabbits. "Were you a mail-order bride?" she inquires of her new mother-in-law, leaning over to pluck another rose. "No. Humphrey and I met at work." "You worked together?" Swanee stifles a melancholy laugh. "Were you a receptionist?" "We met at my work." Katya delivers the information robotically. "Not his." "Oh." Swanee's read enough erotica to fill in the blanks. Katya herself is a blank, a sexual tabula rasa upon which the worst conclusions are easily drawn. Swanee changes the subject. "Well, you're certainly rich now. That must be a relief." "Is it for you? Are you glad to take my son's money and have the run of his household?" There's no challenge in Katya's inflection, but the words are clear enough. Swanee goes on the offensive. "I am, actually. He's a worthless human being, but it would have been a shame to let this opportunity go to waste." Katya smiles, vaguely, and rises from the table. "Have a nice wedding night." Swanee watches her stride long-leggedly away, a formula of perfection fantasized into existence. 36, 24, 36. She names the day-glow magenta hue of Katya's dress like a curse. Hot lips, fashion doll, dragon fruit. To know what a man expects of women, look no further than his mother. "A perfect wife," Swanee observes aloud. "Have you ever met someone so unnervingly polite? It's as though she's been lobotomized. I consider myself quite the feminist, but perhaps some of us weren't made to advance. It's like they say about genes, you can't express what isn't there." "She has her moments, but on the balance, she's a mindless automaton," Duncan Osmond agrees, splashing more end of history in the direction of his glass. "That's why Humphrey's in love with your mother." "What?" Osmond nods in the direction of the dance floor, where Ripple moons around for the videographers, a skeleton crew from his old tube series doing this family memento work for hire as mostly a favor. They've been checking their watches for the last 45 minutes. In the background, Humphrey and Pippi are swaying cheek to cheek. "How horrifying," Swanee murmurs.
"Oh, no. I didn't mean to subject you to another punishing realization."
"But it can't be reciprocated. It can't be. She's still in love with Father."
"Hasn't he been dead for 20 years?
"Nearly 17, but Mother always says she will never love again. She says it very sternly. I never thought to question it."
"Far be it from me to sow the seeds of discord. I have no notion what lurks in her inscrutable heart." Osmond burps, 55% ABV. "Most likely she'll play out the flirtation until it no longer benefits you. Then she'll shatter my brother's hopes, and they'll settle into their natural roles as archenemies. I'm eager to observe, at any rate. Your mother is terrifying, but at least she's alive."
He raps his fist twice on his insensible thigh.
"Which is more than can be said for some of us in this house."
Swanee turns to him with sudden intensity of feeling. "Uncle Osmond, you have the warmest heart of anyone present. You're my only friend in this godforsaken place." Osmond takes this statement very seriously. "You know," he says, gazing at the ancestral tablecloth, stained now from the joyless festivities, "if I had a wedding, it would have been very much like this." He fervently clasps Swanee's small, pudgy hand in his small, pudgy hands. "Only I would have adored you." Swanee begins to cry.
"Is it really so obvious to everyone that Duncan doesn't love me?"
"Of course it is, my child, and hardly unexpected, considering the lout in question. He didn't appreciate the caviar at dinner either."
But...
Swanee blinks back, inky tears, dabs at them with her cloth napkin.
I thought I was irresistible."
"Swanee, no one can resist you forever, and forever is the term on the contract you just signed. I should know. I notarized it."
Forever.
Upstairs in the guest room, Abby is learning the meaning of the term. That is how long she has been stranded here. How long she'll be alone. She's been watching the wedding proceedings for the last 6 hours. They live stream from the videographer's cameras to the house's tube sets, with automated dubbing in a strange, foreign language for the staff. She's seen so much now, so much she can't unsee. Yet she fears she will never understand this world of people. Of her people, she reminds herself, of human beings, just like her. Why are they so strange? She misses walking naked on the beach, feeding cockroaches to the ducks, pooping in a cardboard box. Here, her body stays confined to a single room. Her mind is meant to wander on without it, into the glow worlds of the tube. Duncan is in there now. He has entered the machine, become of it. His body is made from points of light. She sees. She does not understand. She wonders if the next time he slides his tongue into her mouth, she'll feel only a spark of static and then emptiness. She wonders if there will be a next time. She knocks her fist against the screen, but he doesn't turn, not even when she calls his name. He is burning in there. He is changing. Pop up, up, out of this toaster full of souls. Somewhere beyond the mansion's roof in the city below, the dragons scream through the sky. She cannot see them, but she can hear them in her head. A sound so faint and far away, it is a whispered wail, a shrilling in her ears. Ah! The animals of our city are deeply confused, and most of those animals are us.
There was a guy. An underwater guy who controlled the sea. Got killed by 10 million pounds of sludge from New York and New Jersey.
This month is going to happen. This month is going to happen.
You've been listening to Chandler Klang Smith reading from her new novel, The Sky Is Yours, over WBAI in New York.
Creature in the sky got sucked in a hole. Now there's a hole in the sky.
The aptly named Pixies. And you thought that Pixies had high voices, didn't you? Well, not on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City. They don't. That was a great reading.
Well, thank you so much, Jim.
And yeah. I am exceedingly critical of readings. Now, of course,
you should hold up cards that say like 2.5, like 1.
No,
you know,
no,
like,
this is like nines and tens. Is, yeah, no, I don't know if you're aware that I teach writers how to read.
Yes, I know that you do that at ReaderCon, right?
Like I do. I've done it at ReaderCon, at CapClave.
Yeah.
I've done it at the Nebulas for SFWA. I've done it twice for SFWA. I'm thinking of doing a Me, Myself, and I course.
Yeah. No, I mean...
Just for people.
I think it's an incredibly important skill for writers, and I go to a lot of readings, as you know, and it's just like, you know, it's so varied, like, you know, people's confidence levels and
You follow you know, rule number one, you're telling a story.
Yeah, totally.
Rule number two, read slowly.
Yeah, that's something I definitely struggle with. I speak very quickly, so I have to really slow down the natural pace of my voice, like when I'm reading.
That was the perfect pace.
Well, thank you.
And rule number three is differentiate the characters,
yes,
as long as you're consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And rule number four is no, read slowly.
Yeah.
In the outline that I give people, I have read slowly about 5 times.
Yeah, it's surprising how much faster you go than you realize you're going when you're reading out loud. So that's something I've definitely learned over time. But it has been a journey and continues to be. So, yeah.
Watch
absolutely.
You're going to have one hell of a week next week.
I have a bunch of stuff coming up on Tuesday. Can I go ahead and plug my events?
Yes.
Well, on Tuesday, everyone in the listening audience is invited to all of these. On Tuesday, I'm going to be doing a launch at Books Are Magic in Brooklyn.
Who is Gabe Hudson?
Gabe Hudson is this terrific writer. He wrote this book that came out in 2017, Gork the Teenage Dragon. So we have the dragon thing in common. And we connected over social media, really hit it off.
And yeah, he's going to be my conversation partner. So I'm going to do a short reading at that event.
I'm going to try to get to that for not only to be for your launch, but also because I have evil intent in mind in meeting the Books Are Magic people.
Yes, you should definitely meet the Books Are Magic people if you haven't. Emma Straub, I think I
met her years ago,
yeah,
like through her father or something.
Of course,
like that,
yeah.
The great writer Peter Straub.
Yeah.
She's a great writer herself.
Totally.
But the thing is that the reading series that we do here,
yeah,
needs a book vendor.
That would be awesome. So you should definitely come for that reason.
Who better? They're half a mile from here?
Yeah, it's in this neighborhood. So you should definitely come.
So I want to connect with them. I want to see the store.
Yeah, the store is adorable. It's funny, they have a neon sign inside that sort of matches the writing on the cover of my book. They have a neon Books Are Magic sign that's just absolutely wonderful. It's one of the most charming bookstores in the city, so you got to go check it out. And 7:30 on the 23rd, I will be there doing a reading and in conversation with the amazing Gabe Hudson.
And then on Wednesday.
Yeah, the following night, I will be participating in the Yeah, You Write reading series at Bo's Restaurant, which is in the West 20s. I do not actually have the address in front of me, but it's Bo's.
6 West 24th.
6 West 24th Street.
He said, looking at her website.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's a really terrific reading series. It's a very eclectic reading series. So each time they have several different authors who work in kind of different modes. I will be reading with Hermione Hobie, who has a debut novel, I believe it's called Neon in Daylight, that just came out and has been getting great press. I think that that's the title of her novel. And then I'm really, really excited because I'm going to be reading another person in that event. Lineup is Victoria Riddell, who is the author of, among other books, Loverboy, which was turned into a movie. With Kevin Bacon and Kira Sedgwick. And and she's just an amazing writer. And she was one of my professors at Columbia. So when I was in the MFA program at Columbia University. So it's really wonderful to reconnect with her through this. And there are also going to be a couple of playwrights whose work I'm less familiar with, but sound
Robert
amazing.
Robert Hyde and John Gilman.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they will also be incredible.
I just knew that off the top of my head.
I know. You just have this encyclopedic knowledge of my website.
Of websites, exactly.
Right. So that'll be really fun. They have themed cocktails to go with each of the books that are being read from. So there will be some sort of dragon-themed cocktail, which will be really fun. And
cinnamon, too much cinnamon. I know it now.
We were sort of talking about ideas to pass along to the bartender, and I was like, you could go a smoky route. You could go, it'll be a surprise to me.
Definitely
too.
Definitely smoky, something peaty.
Yeah.
A peaty scotch.
That was actually exactly a suggestion I gave. Or maybe a scorched lemon peel or something. So it'll be some sort of
a peaty scotch with a scorched lemon peel, yes.
They have a fabulous
Lefroy.
Premier
Lefroy.
Totally. Well, I don't know if it'll be that. I'm not making any promises, but
that would be expensive too.
That's true. They have a tremendous mixologist there. I've been to events there before, and they always come up with really fun drinks. There's good food there. So that's on Wednesday, and then on Thursday.
At
6:30. Oh, actually, that is one way in which my website is slightly wrong. It's actually at 7 o'clock. That has been adjusted.
But people should show up at 6:30.
Yeah, sure. But 7 o'clock. And actually, if you are interested in going to that one to make sure you have a seat, you might want to make
a
reservation. You might want to make a reservation. You can just contact the restaurant. So it's Bo's Restaurant. If you just send them an email and say you're attending, Yeah, You Write, they'll put you on the list.
Yeah, that's just B-O apostrophe S.
Yes, that's right. And then the third thing is not actually a reading, unlike the other two events. It is just going to be a publication party, but that is open to the public and where I will be selling and signing books. And that is at the KGB Bar third floor Red Room space.
Not the same space as the Fantastic
Fiction. Yes. So if you're familiar with Fantastic Fiction, it
then
is not there.
Go one
flight up from there to the third floor where there is an Art Deco speakeasy space that was, recently remodeled. It's really gorgeous and charming, and I will be hanging out. There will be cookies with dragons on them, and lots of fun conversation, books for sale. So please come. So those are
the events that I'm doing next week. Yeah.
Okay. And then later on next month, you're doing the Line Break series at QED, which is always great. Bill Shun runs that.
Again, just a really wonderfully eclectic reading series.
And then you're going to descend one floor.
Indeed. I'm going to do Fantastic Fiction at the KGB, which is in the regular second floor space.
And Kelly Robeson.
Yeah. I'm really excited to read with her. And I'm so excited to read in that series because along with Nursif, it's one of the ones those are the two series that I try to go to every month. So to be able to participate in it is
and then saving the best for last.
Of course, the very best. You can tell the audience about that again.
That's Amy Goldschlager guest hosting.
Yes, yeah,
that's right, with Chris Claremont and Chandler Klang Smith.
Yeah,
that's on.
Is that
April 3rd?
Is that, and it is still on
although
April 3rd?
I have to look into that. I would like to change it to the 10th.
Because I knew there had been some discussion about that. I think that I can do...
Because it's the third day of Passover.
Yeah, I totally hear that. So
the third night of Passover.
If it's an issue and we need to change it, that one is maybe subject to change, but I will be reading with Chris Claremont.
It depends on Chris's availability and the availability of the space.
Yeah.
And the reason I know third night of Passover is not... a highly celebrated one. However, I, for example, cook a second Seder, as they call
it. Totally.
So the night before, you've been to my house.
Oh, yeah.
I'm doing that on the night before.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah.
Not
as
many.
You're doing
people,
like a potluck thing? Yeah.
No. It's not potluck.
Oh, it's all
it's
you.
It's a sit down. No, I made everything at that dinner you were at.
All of the food at your party, your holiday party, is made by you
me.
And Barbara? That's crazy.
Just
you.
Sorry, just me.
Not even Barbara.
No. Barbara, at this point, Barbara does join in.
Okay.
The recipes are all mine or derived by me.
You know, there's always so much food that I just assumed lots of people bring things. And that's why
desserts.
I brought cookies.
People bring desserts and they bring wines.
Yeah.
But the food.
Oh, that's
is all
so
me.
Interesting. Well, fabulous job.
The
I always
meatballs,
enjoy
lasagna.
A lot.
And my prized chicken wings.
Yeah,
I make
those were
fabulous
really yummy
smoked paprika chicken wings.
Yeah, that must be the secret ingredient. So it's
a real secret. I got it from Epicurious. although they ask for a teaspoon.
I always
2 tablespoons, people.
I always greatly
paprika
increase.
Paprika is mild.
We make tomatoes roasted with smoked paprika frequently.
Smoked paprika, ask for it by name.
It is a pretty amazing spice. Well,
it really is. We are speaking of pretty amazing spices.
Yeah.
Thank you, and Lister. And as promised, okay, Eric, I wasn't joking. Okay, there he is. There he is. We didn't get to see the actual unveiling.
Mm-hmm.
this time, although sure. I do think that people tune in. I think people tune in toward the end of the show just to see Lister.
I mean, why wouldn't they? Absolutely.
It's like the tower. He's an Eiffel. Ba-dum.
Oh, my God. Okay. I've never heard that one before.
Yeah, neither have I, and I hope to never hear it again. I wish we could go another hour easily.
Well, this was delightful. Thank you so much for having me. This was, this was really, really fun.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Of course.
Chandler Klang Smith will be back on this program, but not before you go to see her at one of the venues. Go to Chandler Klang, that's Klang with a K, Smith.com for much more information. And On the Sky is Yours by the aforementioned Chandler Klang Smith.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I'll be back next week from 1 to 3 a.m., and I have not yet set the agenda, so be afraid. Be very afraid. Please, everybody, be good to each other. Lots of anniversaries that we'll be honoring this year, from the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein to the 50th anniversary of 2001. Ooh, and this show is actually sort of, believe it or not, the 45th anniversary of me hosting this radio show.
Congratulations. So,
thank you.
Nice. Yeah.
And we'll call it all of January, but because we don't know the exact date. But again, thank you so much.
Awesome.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay.
We'll be right back. other places will hit.
Number one!
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Number one.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Great show this morning, Jim Carney. We'll be back, same place, same time, right here on the Thursday at your favorite radio station. 99.5, List Alive, WBAI, WBAI.org, yeah, Pablo Moses. Make it 9 minutes after flag burning time right here. 9 minutes after 3 o'clock. We burn the imperialist red, white, and blue to ashes before 5 o'clock. And if it won't burn, we dip it in.
Ready?
That's it. That's it.
Fire. Ready?
Trigger easy, by four.
Shoot when you're sure.
Ready.
Squeeze the trigger easy by four. ready, aim, fire. Ready, aim, fire.
Is better than self-insults. Only your wits can give you direct hits. Constructive results is better than self-insults. Only your wits can give you direct hits.